Hello, boys and girls. Are you sitting comfortably? Then let's begin. Once upon a time, there was a podcast host called Ewan Spence, and he was joined by his two best friends, Rafe Blanford.
Oh, sorry, I was...
I
just lulled into a sense of complete quiet.
Oh, right. Okay, so we're not going to be doing a fairy tale this week, as you can tell everybody. We're going to be keeping you bright and wide awake with all the latest news from the All About Symbian Inside podcast. It is number 103, and now, rather gently woken up by my dulcet tones, we do have Rafe Blanford.
Hello, everybody.
And Steve Litchfield is joining us as well.
I'm here.
And Steve, you probably know how the fairy tale ends, don't you?
Badly, I suspect.
It does, yes. But fairy tales aren't the stories we're here to talk about. Latest news and looking around the ecosystem of the smartphone world, based, of course, on the Symbian operating system. Lots to go over, mostly little bits and pieces and stories and some questions from yourself on Twitter. As always, you can leave your comments back at www.allaboutsymbian.com. And let's go for some news. And the big one, I think, last week was Nokia's Q4 results. These, in the baseball metaphors, hit it out the park, didn't they, Rafe?
They were certainly more encouraging than some of the other results from this from previous quarters in 2009. I wouldn't necessarily say hit it out the park. I would just say they were positive. They were ahead of market expectations, and consequently, Nokia's share price did go up. But as with all of these results, there's always more than one side to the story. But so the headline things that people really need to know about, it's a 1.1 billion euros of profit that Nokia made. Of course, that's up very significantly from the last quarter, which was, you know, a loss because mainly of a write down as a result of Nokia Siemens Network and some underperformance from Navtec. The other sort of big headline result is the 12 billion of net sales. That's actually down 5% year on year. That's really a reflection of the fact that the average selling price of mobile phones has continued to fall, and that more of Nokia's sales is now made up of its lower end portfolio. That's, you know, pretty much the pattern across the industry, actually. The sort of Nokia's device and service division did particularly well, with the making up the vast majority of the profits, up 130% year on year. The only thing I'd say about these year on year results is that Q4 2008 was particularly bad. Of course, that was when the sort of credit crunch was really kicking in for the first time. And they also had some problems with the device portfolio at that point in time. And so I'd be very wary of doing direct year-on-year comparisons, because of that, just as the same as I've said before, for quarter-on-quarter comparisons, especially in the smartphone space where individual device launches can still have an effect. But we'll get on to that in a minute. But the thing that most people listening to this, I suspect, will be interested in were the converged device sales. Nokia in Q4 2009 sold 20.8 million devices. It's one of the highest totals ever. I think it's the second half, maybe in the highest. I'd have to look back through the data. But the point about that is it's up from 15 million the previous year and up from 16.4 million the previous quarter. In terms of market share, that's an increase from 35 to 40%. So the big point here is Nokia's market share in the smartphone space has recovered dramatically. As we indeed said when we looked at the Q3 results, we expected it to do. This is principally due to increased sales of touchscreen devices, of which Nokia sold just about 10 million in the last quarter. A lot of those would have been 5800s and 5530s, sort of at the lower end. Again, that harks back to the decline in net sales overall. I think the interesting point here is if you look at the Q4 smartphone sales, about 5 million more were sold in Q4 than in Q3. But of those, about 4 million or 80% of them were actually Nokia devices. So what this means is that Nokia is growing significantly ahead of the rest of the smartphone market for the first quarter in quite a long time. Relatively speaking, Apple's results, which also came out, I think they saw about a roughly leveling of sales, which is perhaps what you'd expect, but, you know, possibly somewhat disappointing for them. RIM also had some decline, and I think the other extra sales were mainly made up of Android devices, which perhaps isn't altogether surprising given the launch of something like the Motorola Milestone and some of the other Android devices. I think there is one other thing I want to pick out before we sort of go on to a bit of discussion, and that's sort of the relative breakdown of the E-series, N-series and numbered devices. E-series devices continue to do very well. That's 6 million. That's up significantly from what they've been before. I think last quarter they're around the 4 million mark. So, you know, a real blockbusting performance from Nokia's enterprise division. Now, in the roughly the same time frame, RIM will have sold, you'd probably look at about, say, 8 to 9 million devices. So the E-series aren't actually that far off off the RIM total. They still do have the lead RIM, but RIM is actually the other big success story in the smartphone space, which largely gets overshadowed by Apple. But anyway, back to N-series. That's really the disappointing factor. They've continued to be flat in the last quarter. They sold 4.6 million. That really suggests that the N97 has continued to sell quite poorly. There will be a few N900 sales in that total. And, of course, the N97 Mini was just starting to come on stream at the sort of end of that quarter. It'll be interesting to see whether it picks up a bit in Q1. And continuing to grow are the numbered devices. That's things, as I say, like the 5800, the 5530, and in future quarters it will be the 5230 and the 5233. They're now up over 10 million for the first time, which is just a reinforcement of Nokia's continuing strategy of pushing converged devices into the mid-tier, into cheaper devices. And actually, I think we're going to come back to that later in the programme. But yes, all in all, a very encouraging set of results for Nokia, although I think one of the interesting things is this hasn't been picked up quite as widely as I might have expected it to be, given that this is, you know, a very significant piece of market share movement. And I know, Steve, you've been listening to some of the other podcasts and checking out the news. Were you surprised to see a relatively low reaction to this in the sort of general space?
Not really. Most of the tech podcasts and bloggers, they do tend to be USA-based. And rather unfortunate that even if they were going to give Nokia some coverage for this, then the iPad got launched on the day before and completely blotted out all the news cycles. So in retrospect, I wish Nokia kind of hung on a few days for this and they might have got more coverage. But the world's gone iPad mad.
I rather suspect Nokia's results are far more of interest to the financial analysts rather than bloggers. That's the basis for when they get released. But it is an interesting comment. You do have to be careful when to release news, as we talked about with the new Sony Ericsson phone that got announced.
Yeah, and the thing that I found interesting, and Steve, perhaps you can comment on this, is looking around the internet that people seem to think that, you know, it's the idea of selling high-priced devices that's important in the blogosphere, when in actual fact there's two ways that you can build together a good company. One of them is high-value products, and that is pretty much the angle that Apple are taking now, or a volume of products, which Nokia are more and more focusing on with that mid to low device. But that's not as sexy and not as attractive to headline writers on blogs, but both approaches are completely valid to the financial markets. I mean, are you seeing a sort of people just sort of looking down at Nokia because they're not selling a top-end device, because they'd rather sell three mid-range devices?
I'm sure there's an element of this snobbishness, but I just to go back to those results, I was very, very pleased to see that Nokia's number division doing so well. And just anecdotally, I mean, I get loads of people writing into my phone show with their stories of which devices they're enjoying, which devices have been a real star for them. And the number of people who say, oh, yes, usually by email, but sometimes by video, the Nokia 5800 has been a wonderful, wonderful buy. And I had one this morning from a guy in Bermuda who says it's the best smartphone he's ever bought, the Nokia 5800, which would really surprise some people who live in the top end that something so relatively cheap could be such a star. And if just to lead into another thing we wanted to mention in this podcast, the Nokia 5230, which is the kind of the cheaper version of the 5800, is now at £99 on both T-Mobile and Vodafone. No contract, pay as you go in the UK. Admittedly, they are locked, those networks, but that you can get that unlocked for £20 or so. But that's just a staggering value, and it's something like 4 or 5 times cheaper than the top-end devices. And I can quite see why, for example, the likes of the N97 Classic, which is still selling over £400, to be a 4 times the price of this 5230, you can quite see the use case for for buying one of those for your family, for your teenage son or daughter, for your mum or dad, rather than something super, super expensive. So I showed no surprise whatsoever at seeing Rafe's nice chart, showed the numbered series rising and rising, the E series rising and the N series rather dropping. I think Nokia did drop the ball a bit on the N97 Classic with the launch of the version 21 firmware today and version 20 a month or so ago. They have reclaimed some ground, and the N97 Classic today is just about a usable smartphone with relatively few issues. But that we had a horrible period, didn't we, during the middle of last year, and I'm not at all surprised to see the N series down. The N97 Mini is a genuinely nice device. I hope they continue developing the firmware for that, and that could potentially be a real star for 2010, I reckon.
Yeah. And I think that £100 price point, even though it's locked, even though it's only on one network, is psychologically very, very important, especially when you look at the stuff that you're getting the phone. We talked about Navtech last week in the show. Navtech, yes, okay, so they underperformed in the stuff, but now they're creating this great big service. It's available for free. The 5230, it comes with the navigation. It comes with the maps. You've got the music store on there. Admittedly, it's still the music store where you buy per track, but you have the app store on there. Nokia are building, starting to look at all these little diverse pieces of their software side, the software and services that we're building up, and now the hardware is coming into place, and the hardware is also coming into place at the low end of the market, and that is going to create a huge bubble and groundswell. And I think that is why the market went Nokia share price up 10% and made it into a solid buy. And I just want to carry on that thinking in a second, but Rafe, I mean, that £100 mark is one that we've been talking about for a long time as something that Symbian and Nokia have been aspiring to. I mean, now they're here, what's next?
Yes, you're right, Ewan. We have talked about that price point for a long time. Obviously, it varies by market where you draw that psychological barrier, but you're right, it has arrived. And I think the story, you know, going forward here is of tightening up and sort of evolving their service portfolio to go along with it. I'm sure we'll continue to see a gradual push down. I mean, well, the 5230 at £99 in the UK, that will probably dip under, you know, towards the £80 point by the end of the year. And equally, well, Nokia launched the 5233 in India this week, and that's basically the 5230 but without 3G. So again, that cuts off a little bit of the price. But I think it really is about the evolution of services. And building that up, you know, we've heard about the refresh of the Ovi store, which is coming this spring. I think we'll be hearing more about that at MWC, and probably more services. We'll also be getting sort of the next evolution of maps with the sort of the ability to build applications on the top of it. And that starts to have a lot of implications. You know, up until now, you could argue that Nokia has been playing a bit of catch up on in terms of its service offering. I think that's a bit inaccurate, because Nokia offers something rather different with its service platform, and this ties back into the Symbian, into the Nokia results as well, and also the Symbian platform strategy as a whole. Nokia isn't attempting to build something just at the high end. It's attempting to build something for a very large part of the market. And Steve had a good chart on this week, where he drew a, where are the price points of the devices running the respective platforms? And, you know, Symbian and Nokia have devices over a much broader portfolio than anybody else. And so it's continuing to maintain momentum in that area by making sure you evolve and polish the experience so that when you get a phone out of the box, it works as well as possible. So the sort of thing I might expect to see going forward is when you start up the phone, you currently have your phone startup application, which asks you what you want to call the Bluetooth name, helps you set a ringing tone, introduce you to basic concepts. Well, how about adding in an Ovi login screen at the end of that, which would be optional, but once you logged in, it would then log you in for, you know, the map service, the music service, the app store, without you having to enter in everything multiple times. In other words, single sign-on. So it's that kind of experience I would expect to improve over time. And then, of course, what we'll be seeing later in the year is the next version of the platform. So Symbian 3 will be coming in. That's really going to be expected in devices from, let's say, summer onwards, and obviously moving forward onto Symbian 4. So if you like, it's a continuing polishing of the software and the user experience, and kind of the way people use devices will become an as important theme, I think, as the actual cost of the devices themselves, although that will continue too.
And of course, software and services make up a large part of the big announcement that was also happened last week, which is Apple's iPad. Now, we're not all about iPad, iPod, Apple, or anything, but it does have an impact, certainly in the perception of the market, and it did soak up the news cycles, as we pointed out there. Rafe, what are the implications of the iPad in terms of Nokia, Symbian, and the ecosystem that we look at normally?
Well, it's an interesting question that, as you say, iPad dominating the news cycles. I think what stood out for me is it's about the iTunes ecosystem and the opportunity that gives to Apple to sort of stretch into new markets. I actually think the iPad probably isn't the right approach, but it's always very difficult to judge this sort of thing just after an Apple announcement. But I don't really see it as nearly as interesting as something like the iPhone, basically because it's a limited market product. And what I mean by this is I'm sure it's going to sell, you know, a few million in the first year, and it could do much better than that as well. But it's never going to be anything like as important as the sort of mobile phone market generally. But it does demonstrate Apple's sort of the advantage it has from the iTunes ecosystem, and I actually think it makes quite a strong case for, you know, why Nokia is on the right track with its sort of obvious strategy. You know, if you can stretch that out to more devices, that's great. I think it's also interesting because it provides, you know, a stark comparison between the two companies' strategies, and I think this applies to Apple, Google, and Nokia, and also Microsoft. You know, things like the continuing there's no multitasking. There's actually more lockdown in terms of what you can do on something like the iPad, arguably, than there is on the iPhone. For example, the introduction of the micro SIM. Yes, the device is unlocked, but you have to find an operator that has a micro SIM. So, you know, it's not what I'd call a proper unlocked device in that sense, simply because the practicalities of doing it in the market are going to be difficult. But it's also the things that, you know, the lack of the access to the filing system, which we've commented before on with, you know, the iPhone. And sure, I'm sure this is going to be jailbroken and made more available. But it's, you know, for something that is halfway between a smartphone and a laptop, as put by Steve Jobs, it has an awful lot that makes it far more like a phone, or even, dare I say it, sort of a feature phone in the limitations it has imposed on it. And I think this is a reflection of Apple's desire to control everything. And now that isn't necessarily a bad thing, because that's a very good business strategy for creating a compelling device. You know, it's what Apple does best, you know, goes into a new market and sort of revolutionizes it by putting the Apple spin on things. However, I think it has significant implications for Apple's ability to genuinely innovate, as opposed to polish something that already exists. And I'm not saying Apple doesn't innovate at all, but you contrast this with the very much more open approach that I think someone like Google and Nokia are taking, and even to an extent Microsoft, where it's a belief about building products and ecosystems in an open way, and the ecosystem way gives it away. You know, you don't get to do things on Nokia's terms in one sense. I mean, clearly you do. But the ability of third parties to add in their own services, or the flexibility and the openness of the platform, is much greater. And I think you could argue with Google, actually, it's kind of Android has a gatekeeper, and that's Google. And it's for the, you know, betterment of Google, essentially. It's about selling Google services, more search and advertising revenue on the phone itself. And similarly with Microsoft, it's going to be, I think, probably about promoting Microsoft's own service now, be that the gaming or the music stuff, or indeed getting on the productivity applications. Whereas Symbian, as a, you know, a non-profit foundation, is very much about building the infrastructure. Now Nokia is going to build its own stuff on top of that, and that's obvious, and that's what it wants you to use. But in contrast to the others, it's keeping it very much open in terms of being able to plug things in, replace things outright. And that's partly a result of being built on top of Symbian. And so I think we're going to see in the next few years very much a contrast in business philosophies between one that is sort of based on openness and sort of cooperation, of which I think Nokia is, you know, going to be the primary exemplar. Google is a little bit further behind, or maybe in the middle, and Apple is kind of the proprietary, you will do things our way. Clearly they still want to work with third parties, but it's very much more on their terms. And that sort of philosophical business difference, you know, is, you could contrast it between a European and an American way of doing business going forward in the future. I think that's probably far too strong. But there is definitely this ecosystem-led approach, as opposed to an, you know, a single company-led approach. And that's what kind of stuck in my mind with the iPad. But on the whole, I think, like a lot of sort of commentators, I was somewhat disappointed by the iPad. Interesting implications in the ebook market, but I don't really see it as a mass market device, and therefore the sort of long-term implications, aside from maybe reinforcing the iTunes ecosystem, don't really seem all that significant to me, and I don't think it will be as revolutionary as something like, you know, the iPod or, you know, the iPhone were. I think if you look at that smartphone to laptop space, something like MIMO, which is further towards the smartphone than the iPad is, probably has more potential in the longer term, but it's very unpredictable and there's going to be a lot of players in that space.
I disagree about the iPad not being mass market, because I can see a distinct use case here for all sorts of people who aren't geeks to have an easy way that's locked down, virus proof, everything else proof, of accessing the everything on the internet, or apart from Flash, of course, most things on the internet, from the comfort of their sofa, their kitchen, wherever, without having to worry about geeks and troubleshooting repairs and viruses and Windows updates and all the rest of it. And I for one, am going to leap out and buy something like an iPad for my mum and dad. However, what we are all about Symbian. We're talking about mobile phones, smartphones, things that are slightly geeky, where you have to have a bit of technical knowledge, and I don't think the iPad is necessarily relevant to that. So I agree with you that it's not at all relevant in terms of the ecosystem that we live and work in. But I do think the iPad will do pretty darn well on the mass market. MIMO, in contrast, and I don't want to be too down on MIMO, because I've got an N900 and it's quite nice, and it's a really nice geeky toy. I see, saw someone had actually managed to load Mac OS X 10.3 onto the MIMO, and it takes 90 minutes to boot, which I thought was quite amusing. They've also managed to load Windows 3.1 and a few other old operating systems on it. So the N900 really is a terrific little geek workhorse and a geek toy. But the iPad is way, way, way more mass market. It's just not particularly relevant to allaboutsymbian.com, I would argue.
I agree with you in that there may be a space there, but I think the idea that the iPad would take it all together on its own, I just don't really see it. You know, the netbook computers are still going to be there, and I think people prefer to have a device that has the potential to do a lot more, even if they don't necessarily use it. I think there'll be a lot of competition from the likes of Chrome OS running on similar, you know, limited devices. I wouldn't buy a device like this. I want one with a keyboard, because it's the idea of, you know, how many devices does one sort of person own or one family own before it becomes too many? And I'm just not sure there's room for an extra device for the average person here. You know, you have your phone, you have your computer, and I see that a lot of computers are switching to laptop, but I don't really see people owning, you know, a high-end phone or a phone, then something like an iPad, then a laptop as well. So I think most people would stick with it. I mean, I absolutely accept that I may be wrong, but I just think it's, you know, too small a gap to fit into to be mass market. And when I say mass market, I mean, you know, sales in the hundreds of millions as opposed to, you know, tens of millions, you know, going further forward. I'm not very interested in it. I think I'll probably pick one up out of curiosity. But it's just, I find it difficult to see it displacing the laptop. I think we've seen plenty of attempts to do that. I think its space is just limited.
I just think it has quite rightly created a new market that didn't exist before. Obviously there were tablet PCs before, but they didn't take off because they ran a really clunky version of Windows and they had all the problems that Windows goes along with Windows. To actually introduce a tablet PC that's small enough and light enough that the average person in the street, not the geek in the street, will actually want to pick up and use without having to worry. I've got three, four PCs around the house, two Macs, umpteen smartphones, various tablets of various kinds, and all the ones running Windows need updates almost daily from Windows Update. It is a real pain keeping them up to date, the antivirus up to date, and sorting out tech support problems. And to have something that you can literally give to a non-technical friend and say, here you are, you use the internet, use this, use the applications, load on some movies, you won't have any problems with it, and not have to worry about them phoning you every day. I think that's just a step forward. And I for once, I think Apple actually are right. They have created a new market. It may not be as big a market as things like phones or as PCs or as even netbooks, but there is a distinct market there, and I do think they're going to sell a significant number of devices.
I'm more with Steve on this one. I think that the iPad is very much an iceberg play, and for two reasons. First of all, the perception of this device. HP launched an incredibly similar device at CES about 2 weeks ago and got almost no pickup on the news. Channel 4 News had this as a news flash the second it came out. This went in every single media property. Everybody knows this is out there. So first of all, the perception is this is a device that the man or the woman in the street will want. Do not discount that. Secondly, Steve Jobs, through the press, and yes, through his PR, said that this is the device that will change everything and the device that he is most proud of. This is the guy that canned the Newton. This is the guy that said, we're not having a PDA or a tablet in my watch until it works. So I think there's a lot more going on here. And I think there are two important things that I spotted in there. The first one was iWork, the addition of Office and Productivity Suites into this. And secondly, Apple still have not refreshed the MacBook range. I suspect that once the iPad works out all the bugs and all the geeps, has helpfully debugged everything and proved the concept that it works on a big screen, maybe with a Bluetooth keyboard or the keyboard dock that Apple are so handily making and didn't draw attention to, that when they redo the MacBooks, the sort of 10 to 13 inch machines, they're going to have the iPhone OS and not Mac OS, because at that point they will have a basic machine with a good web browser, good productivity tools to bring in at $700, and Steve Jobs will have a completely closed ecosystem, and every piece of content that goes onto your laptop, be it music, be it video, be it TV, be it applications, all comes through him, and he takes a 30% play. This isn't just a smartphone or mobile market. This is to capture the entire Apple ecosystem, so Steve Jobs can earn something off every single thing you do on your own laptop. That is why he is so impressed with this iPad, and that's why 90% of it is underneath the surface and why everybody is avoiding that.
Yeah, I have to say that I think there's only an element of truth in that. Maybe the bottom 10% of the MacBook market were people who are happy to switch to something like the iPad, but 90% of the MacBook market is for people who do want to proper computers, and it's a MacBook can do just as much as a laptop PC. It's a full multitasking, full modern OS, and people are using it for real grown-up tasks. I'm currently running about 8 different applications on the Mac in front of me at the moment, just like you would with a Windows PC, and there's no way you get even close to what I do on my Mac with an iPad. So yes,
but the man in the street wanting a laptop will be quite happy with this in 2 years' time. And then Steve Jobs gets 30% on everything. The people who want the MacBook Pro get that, but you open up a brand new market of basic low-end laptop. You sell even more of them. So and basically, they're in a volume game that Nokia are doing with their handsets.
Basically, we are talking about Steve Jobs' plan for world domination. And if you go back to your DVD collection and Tomorrow Never Dies, and look at the is it Mr. Carver, Max Carver, or Elliot somebody Carver?
Elliot Carver.
Hello, is there not a distinct resemblance between Steve Jobs 2010 and Mr. Carver in terms of they look almost identical? It is scary, and they both have plans for world domination. So there's a thought for the day.
Yes, you may think that we couldn't possibly comment. What we can comment on is Skyfire, which does sound like an evil James Bond product. Steve, the Skyfire web browser, I know you've been dealing with this now for quite a few months, and they've updated and finally released a version for the touch devices in Series 65th edition. And it's got Flash! Woo! Back to geeky things.
It's got everything. It's the Skyfire has got Silverlight, and every other thing you could possibly render on your desktop also now renders on your mobile, although, albeit, going via their proxy server, where it basically transcodes everything and sends it down in a proprietary Skyfire-ish format, and then your client then displays it, and it includes streaming video from things like Silverlight and the very latest version of Flash. The significant thing here is, yes, that it's now the first one that actually works on S65th edition devices. I wouldn't get your hopes up too much, because, for example, if you wanted to go and watch something on BBC iPlayer, via Skyfire, it is still rather jerky, and I suspect that there are still optimizations that Skyfire have to do. They've taken months to get it onto 5th edition devices, so obviously it has been a bit of a problem getting the performance up, but they still need to get it up further if it's going to be genuinely usable. At the moment, it is kind of a curiosity. They've done some good work in terms of integrating social networks. They've got, you know, full Ajax scripting, so you can work with some pretty interactive sites. But I would say 1.5 is just a stepping stone, and maybe 1.6 or maybe even a version 2.0 will get to the point where people might actually start to use it as their main browser.
And it's also interesting they're taking the same approach as Opera, which is to use a remote server to do all the squishing and shrinking and then pushing it down that way. And that also allows them to add in things like advertising, which Opera picked up with this stuff as well. Skyfire's business model, are they're going for putting advertising in pages or affiliates, or because it is a free download.
Yeah, they're picking up revenue from things like when you do a search on Google, if you then click on an ad, they'll get a percentage of that. So they've done a deal with Google for the search thing, and I imagine they may try and do similar things for affiliate. I mean, I suspect at the moment the principal aim is establishing some market share, but just as the same way that Opera eventually went free and basically did that off search revenue, and indeed Firefox, a lot of the funding for the Mozilla Foundation comes off the deal on the Google search box. So it's that's the main business model, although it'll be worth discussing where else that could go with Firefox if we get a chance at a future date.
Yes, worth saying you can get Skyfire by going to get.skyfire.com in web, actually on your phone, and it all loads over the air, which is really rather nice. And I don't know, do you know if it has automatic in-place updates, Rafe? Will it tell you of new versions?
I don't think it does necessarily. I'd have to check that out. I haven't upgraded to the latest version myself, but I do use it as a sort of secondary browser to be able to handle stuff I can't get elsewhere. You know, perhaps not unusually amongst phone geeks tend to have several browsers on the go at any one time, including the built-in one, Opera, the sort of native version, and Skyfire as well.
There we go. Now, of course, we've got some reader, viewer, listener, media, consumer, whatever you want to call them, questions coming in from Twitter. The Dark Fury, we've kind of half answered it already, but let's take that one now. It's a question coming to us Twitter, and our account there is @AAS. Where do you guys see the future of advertising subsidies playing a role in networks pricings? I mean, where networks drop their prices by sending ads to the users, and how do you guys see this relating to LTE's pricing?
Ooh, yes, interesting question. If you look in the last week, Orange have launched something called Orange Shots, which enables advertisers to deliver a targeted message, I think, to its Orange Monkey subscribers, which I think is kind of appropriate in some ways. And this is essentially sending a text message or an MMS message. And, you know, we had the whole MVNO, whose name just escapes me, Blick, something like that, who was also on this model of basically free credit for listening to an advertising message. Do I think that will play more of a role in the future? It's difficult to say. Yes, I think there's going to be a certain amount of opt-in of this kind of thing, but I think it will have to be opt-in, and I'm not sure how popular it will get. Does it relate particularly to LTE pricing? No, I don't think so. I think this could work on across any technology. There are some enablers that may make it more likely. And I do think it's interesting in the context of Android, where we're starting to hear the idea that Google may be paying operators a portion of the sort of advertising fees that result in from using Google services on their phones. And, you know, reports have varied that this can be anything up to sort of about $25 per customer per handset. And obviously that then has implications for the consumer. That's a sort of a more hidden one, in the sense that it's not advertising that you'll see clearly defined as coming from something like a campaign, but, you know, it does quite have implications for operators might be keener to pick up Android if they get some help on the subsidy pricing of the handset itself, or just an alternative revenue stream. But I'm a bit sceptical about this sort of thing, because I think advertising direct in a sense like that probably has a limited future. The stuff that works best, and it does work on mobile, you look at something like Real Madrid and Barcelona, who've had some great success in terms of communicating with their fans by messaging and had excellent engagement rates. But it coming through an operator, I'm less sure about that. I mean, I think consumers will prefer to communicate directly with the brands, could the brands then do deals with the operators? Quite possibly. I mean, it's not really an area I've given much thought to, but yeah, interesting question, definitely. But brief answer, I'm not sure it'll have that much of a wide impact.
Okay, and the corner, of course, is so much of Web 2.0 is still built on step two, let's get some advertising and affiliates, that, you know, the networks are probably, you know, more careful than most to go down that route of relying on advertising.
Yeah,
as one of their income streams. So it's different for smaller startups and more agile businesses when you have a network that's got huge commitments. You know, it's like you really want to, you know, make the trade, make the risk, you know, when they won't even risk, or we'll use the firmware from the factory, we'll put our bit on top of it as well.
Yeah, I mean, yes, it will play a role. Will it be mainstream in the short term? No, I think it's a longer term thing.
Indeed, yeah. So I can see some, as you said, we've mentioned Blake there, but also GIFGAF as well, which is the MVNO out of O2 in the UK. I can see them dabbling with this, but yeah, certainly not in the mainstream.
And in one sense, the whole service provision, be that of the, you know, Apple, Google, they're all going to be selling advertising in certain spaces, and they may well cut in the operator on that, which may then get passed on to the consumer. And I think that's probably the most likely model, as I was talking about with the Android. But, you know, for example, location advertising on top of maps, and the operator may be given, say, you know, a 10% share of anything that happens across their network. And that's certainly possible. But I think that's a few years further away than people might imagine.
Indeed. Right. We have another question also coming in from James Berland. Thank you for your question, James. Does the team think it's possible that we'll see one hardware design that supports dual boot, i.e. both Symbian and MIMO? Will we see it direct from the manufacturers? I don't think so. I don't think any manufacturer would dilute the message of putting two choices on there. Where I think we'll see it, of course, is in the hackers. And certainly when you look at something like netbooks, my netbook sitting here has got three operating systems built into it. It can go to Windows 7, it can go to Ubuntu, or it can go to the new fancy one from Intel, which is named
Moblin.
Escapes me right now. Moblin, that's the one. Thank you very much. But those are ones done by the consumer hacker at home. I think Dell offer a choice when you buy which operating system you'd like on your netbook. They're giving you the choice of Moblin or Windows 7, but not actually on the device itself. Rafe?
Yes, I agree with you here, Ewan. I don't think it will be a consumer proposition direct from Nokia. However, I think I think the most likely way this will happen will be that future MIMO devices will also be able to boot Symbian, and it will probably be a community-led initiative. The other way around is probably less likely, simply because some of the requirements for the majority of Symbian devices will be less capable of running MIMO because of MIMO's higher requirements. Top-end devices, yeah, it's possible. I mean, at the moment, MIMO has a sort of minimum requirement of OMAP 3, amongst other things, and we only have OMAP 3 devices from Samsung and Sony Ericsson. That will change, of course, in the future. But sort of MIMO 6, which is when I'd anticipate this sort of thing happening in a mainstream fashion. Yeah, it's an interesting thing, but yeah, you're right. There is very little reason to see Nokia doing this themselves. But because they're both open source, and you know, there is going to be open source to the extent you will be able to get at things like the bootloader, because with MIMO 6 there will be two versions, one that's locked up a bit, which will be what will be sold through networks, for example, and there will be an unlocked version which allows you to do pretty much anything to the device. And the, you know, Symbian is due to go open source in due course, and so everything would be available for someone to go ahead and do it. And I think this is one of the interesting things. If you're running you know, the current Symbian on the hardware capabilities of the N900, Symbian would probably look a lot more impressive to most people, simply because at the moment it's somewhat limited by the hardware. Just as you look at something like, you know, the i910 and how impressive that can be, just in terms of its capabilities for things like the HD video recording. So interesting question, but James, I don't really see you being able to walk into a phone shop and buying a dual boot device anytime soon.
Indeed. I think the best thing that we can hope for is that the manufacturers leave the devices and the bootloaders open, so people can, on their own choice, dual boot the system, and perhaps give them guidance as well on, if you want to do this, you can, but be warned, when you alter the bootloader file, you'll change the licensing requirement, the the warranty agreements and we're no longer going to support the device. I hope we would see that in all devices, but I don't see them, you know, having multiple plugins and you can, away you go and choose. For a start, you double the cost of getting the thing certified for going up onto networks and connecting. And can you imagine the mess if you had to put two Orange firmwares on top of your device for different operating systems? I'm not singling out Orange. I could be any manufacturer or network or whatever. Anyway, before we get ourselves into more trouble, I think it's best to say goodbye. So goodbye from the All Bits and Mean podcast. As always, comments are welcome through Twitter to @AAS, back on the website, www.allaboutsimeon.com. And it just remains me to thank the guys as usual for pulling out the moderator share for me once every 6 weeks just to keep me happy. So thanks to Rafe Blanford.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you to Steve Litchfield.
Steve Litchfield on Twitter, by the way. Do follow me. Yep. Thanks very much. Bye for now.
There we go. And thank you also you out there for listening to the show. It's great to have you and great to have your feedback as we carry on going down the years. Show 104 will be along at some point in the next week. But for now, thank you for listening.